We begin the two-week seminar session in a thick fog. I hope we don't end that way. You'll notice I am not wearing a coat and tie. I debated it briefly. Last time I didn't, and I was very happy I didn't, but I thought, well, I'm older now. Maybe I should make more pretensions of some kind. So I thought, well, maybe I should do that, but I brought a coat. I didn't even bring a tie. Given the humidity today, I'm glad I didn't. I assume you'll see pools forming around me as I speak. I'm reminded of the line from Shakespeare's Henry IV, Part 1, Falstaff sweats to death and lards the lean earth as he walks along. seems appropriate for such a humid morning as this. At the academy, I'm required to wear a coat and tie, so this is a little bit of hooky for me, as well as a chance to be here, a wonderful opportunity to address all of you. I have a colleague right across the hall who's actually a decent teacher. He's a nature type. He's into the 19th century American transcendentalists. We'll talk a bit about them next week when we come to Hawthorne. But a good fellow who actually teaches something, and he detests having to wear the tie. He keeps one behind his door. And when he goes to class, he'll throw it around his neck, and it never matches. It's always the same tie, no matter what he's wearing. And as soon as he gets out of class, he rips the tie off. I'm reminded this summer when I was lecturing in Italy just recently, I met a young man from Prague, devout Catholic. And I was complaining to him about the wearing of ties, and he said, I know, I hate wearing ties too. When I was tortured by the communists, they choked me at one point, and since that time, I can't stand having anything around my neck. So we should... What for me is a personal discomfort... can in a much larger sense be of great significance. A point I'd like to make about literature as well. Literature is entertaining. It's one of the reasons I particularly love it. But it can be, I believe, of great benefit, and that's the reason that we study it. Just a quick rundown in terms of what's happening today. And this will be the schedule overall. I will give two lectures in the morning, one at 9 o'clock, one at 11. There will be an afternoon discussion session that I will oversee, but it's basically for you to ask questions, and bring up anything you want, and we'll go through some of the material on a level that I won't be able to get into here. So if you have questions, please just hold them to this afternoon. I'll be glad to go over almost anything. And then there's going to be various things happening in the evening. There will almost always be something in the evening, but it's going to vary from day to day. So we will keep you posted. What happens there? It seems appropriate to begin this particular literature seminar by going all the way back to the beginnings, in a sense. We're heading all the way back to Greece. The first thing we're going to look at is one of the great masterpieces ever conceived by the mind of man, Sophocles' Oedipus Rex, Oedipus the King. It comes from the 5th century B.C., and I'm going to give you a lot of background information this morning before we get into the play, partially because that world is very foreign to us. That drama is very foreign to us. In order to even begin to understand the greatness of this play and what was done, we need to go back and get some sense of the world that it sprang out of. Now I'm going to make a little distinction here that is a curious one, but it is of some interest. And that is why those of us who are Catholic should be going back and studying pagan literature. And the fact of the matter is, the Greeks, certainly of the 5th century, are what we would call pagans. Why not spend our time looking at that tradition out of which our faith springs? We have great, great works from that past, particularly the glories of sacred scripture. Could not this time be better spent looking at sacred scripture? And particularly in the modern world, it's very popular to look at sacred scripture as literature. It's become a game that's gone on for the past decades. We're deliberately not doing that here. And I want to make a distinction, because I believe that the Lord God in his wisdom has given us a number of great gifts and has given them in different ways. And in order to allow myself the following remarks, I will rely on a much greater man than myself, and that is St. Thomas Aquinas. One of the great gifts that Aquinas gave to the church, and that Aquinas gave to all of those who followed after him, was that he put a blessing of a kind on studies of the classical world. There was a debate that was going on at that point in history. We're back in the 13th century. And there was a debate going on as to whether or not those pagan writers should be studied. What was the point of looking at them? They did not have God's revelation. They were not the chosen people. What they set down was not sacred scripture. Therefore, the argument ran, what is the point of studying them? Why look at them? When St. Thomas wrote the Summa, he knew very well that in one sense, without being blatant about it, he was sanctioning the study of the ancients. And all the way through the Summa, whenever you come upon the wonderful phrase, the philosopher, and the figure is simply called that, it is St. Thomas referring to Aristotle. And he refers to Aristotle throughout the Summa with great honor, and makes clear that there is much to be learned from Aristotle. And in doing that, St. Thomas opened up, in one sense, that field of inquiry, and many devout Catholics following St. Thomas then felt free to look at that ancient world, to look at those pagan writers, and see what they had to offer. It's for that reason, for example, that throughout Dante's Divine Comedy, Dante feels quite comfortable in mixing what we know of church history and sacred tradition with classical mythology. If you think in the Inferno of the River of Blood, where the murderers are immersed, they are guarded over by the centaurs, half horse, half men, who with their arrows will shoot down any soul that tries to come up above the waters of blood, and the centaurs shoot their arrows and the damned souls sink back down into the River of Blood. Had it not been for St. Thomas, it is unlikely Dante could have included the centaurs. They're from Greek mythology. They would have seemed out of place. But the part of the richness of the Divine Comedy comes from the fact that that classical world was opened up for study. St. Thomas gave us that. I'm going to just draw the distinction this way, and it is this. I may be wrong. This is simply personal opinion. There are two rivers that flow into Western civilization. Most importantly, of course, is that grand Judeo-Christian tradition, the chosen people of God who received divine revelation directly, who set it down and gave for us sacred scripture, and living in history through time, setting down what God revealed, granted revelation to the world, so that when the Savior came, when God himself became incarnate, we could comprehend, we could understand. Revelation is there through tradition and sacred scripture, so that we can know what God demands of us. But the fact of the matter is that God chose one people. God came through that particular line. Being in time, being born as one man, did not mean that God had turned his back completely on the rest of the world. And it seems to me that if that proud sacred tradition, the tradition of the chosen people, the tradition of revelation, we have in the classical world a special grace that God gave to some other people. And that is the gift of reason. Showing to the world through those great pagan writers, through those great classical writers, that a mind that searches honestly can still go a long way toward approaching the truth. It cannot go all the way because revelation is necessary to get us finally to a complete understanding. But what distinguishes that glorious age that we find in Athens that continued on and was passed on to Rome was, if you will, a searching people. Not a chosen people, but a searching people. Minds that were alive, that had indeed, it seems to me, been granted some particular grace in order to accomplish the remarkable things they accomplished. And through that search, through that ongoing search for the truth, for understanding, by using the great gifts that God had given to them, were able to build on nature, overcome much that, of course, touched with original sin, as we all are, much that was destructive in their nature, and leave us a different kind of legacy. A legacy that is of great value, that is worth exploring, although, of course, it can never replace revelation. It can never be equated with revelation. But it is still a body of work that can be extremely useful because in their pursuit of truth, they came to a kind of wisdom and passed it on to us. For that reason, we're going to start with something Greek. And I wish to do homage to those people in the greatness of this particular play. And I will say this as well. What I am finding more and more in my own teaching, as it becomes increasingly difficult to talk about revelation directly to young people today, this is a problem that we will get into next week when we look at Walker Percy's The Moviegoer, something that he deals with directly in that novel. It is surprisingly very easy to begin laying the foundations to build a vision of revealed truth on through the Greek writers. I find I am teaching Plato a lot, I'm speaking a lot about Aristotle, and I'm teaching the Greek dramatists more and more. Because modern man, in his isolation and his irrationality, can learn volumes from the Greeks who believed in reason and who believed in the importance of the individual within the social context. And I'll get into that again this morning. There are basic lessons that we have forgotten that the Greeks can teach us. And in a sense, because they pursued the truth with a measure of honesty, they can go a long way towards leading us down a road where then revelation can take over and the fullness of truth can be granted. In some ways, it's much easier now to deal with them than it is to deal with more immediate and more direct revealed truth. We're back in the 5th century B.C. We're in the city-state of Athens, one of the glories of all civilization. There's much to be said, but I don't want to turn this into a lecture on the glories of ancient Greece, although they were many. I'm going to concentrate them on one aspect of that great civilization, and that is the Greek theater. But the Greek theater is not similar, really, in any way, to the theater as we know it today. What happened to those Athenians when they went to the theater in 427 B.C. in order to see a new play by Sophocles called Oedipus Rex is not the same thing as a group of American theatergoers who go to see a touring company of the Phantom of the Opera or Les Miserables in Minneapolis. It is a completely different experience at root, even though there may seem to be superficial likenesses. Let's go back, and I'll give you just a brief sense of where the theater experience comes from. And I'll make the links in a couple of ways. One of the things that defined Athens as a great city-state that gave it a sense of identity was a great military victory. This is often the case. A people come to know themselves when they win a great battle. That exuberance with which America came out of the Second World War had a great deal to do with our belief that we had won a great victory. The same thing happened in Athens in the year 480 BC. After a great naval battle that took place at Salamis, S-A-L-A-M-I-S, the Persians had attacked, the Athenians rose up, and in the grand battle, they defeated the Persians, went back to the city of Athens with a new sense of self, with a sense of power, with a sense of identity. And indeed, curiously, we do know that in the great hymns of celebration that were sung, the gods were thanked instantly for this great victory. In the hymns of celebration, a young 15-year-old actor, young boy, led the singing of the hymns. His name was Sophocles. It's the first we hear of him. He began, if you will, as a singer of hymns. You'd be hard-pressed to find a modern dramatist who began in that way. The point I am making is that there is a connection between the theater and worship, right from the beginning of the Athenian city-state. First and foremost, the theater grows out of worship, and particularly those hymns of praise that were sung to the gods. They were called dithyrambs. Simply means hymns, dithyrambs. They were works of poetry. They were works of song. They were hymns of praise. They would be sung in processions honoring the gods. The processions would move through the streets of Athens. Probably very few of you have had an opportunity. I was lucky enough to do it once, the summer I was in Brazil, to actually participate in a gigantic Corpus Christi procession that goes through the streets of a city. It was absolutely remarkable. The special carpets of design spread out on the streets. Probably 10,000 people marching through the streets. The streets lined with others. As the Blessed Sacrament passed by, everyone in the city, even those who were not regular churchgoers, bowing before the sacrament, it was the city turning out in worship. We find that in Athens. They were worshiping these mythic gods. They were worshiping false gods. But part of what gave them their dignity was that though they were pagans, they were pious. They had a sense of the need to worship, and that the gods that were there demanded that worship from them. It's the reason why it is grossly unfair to call the modern citizens of the modern world pagan. We are far below pagan. We feel no such piety. We feel no such need to worship. That need to worship was in them, and they worshiped, and the processions moved through the streets, and they sang the dithyrambs. They sang the hymns in praise of the gods. Very many times, specific gods would be praised, and one of the most famous festivals came to be the festival of Dionysus. Yes, you can't see that. I used the wrong color, I'm sorry. I'll go back to the basic green. There we go, yes. Dionysus was a god who was worshipped in the springtime for obvious reasons. He was the god of fertility. He was also the god of wine. The two things have always gone hand in hand. The festival of Dionysus occurred in the springtime because it was a festival in honor of the rebirth of that world around them. Those of you that have been to Greece know it is a hard, rocky, mountainous place. The beautiful seas around, but the fact that life can spring back to life at that time of the year is miraculous in its way. Dionysus was that force, was that god, who brought that green world back to life, and he was honored as a result. In late March and early April, the processions would take place through the streets. Hymns would be sung in his honor. And we know at one point, out of that choral singing, the choral song, a single voice stepped forward. One man stepped out of the chorus, at which point you had Individual voice and choral response. That man was called Thespis. He is a legendary figure. We don't know much about him. The name does survive. And for that reason, actors to this day are called Thespians in his honor. He was the first actor, as far as we know. And you had, with the individual actor's voice and the chorus, an exchange back and forth. This again is tentative. I'll give it to you. I think it is of some interest. Very often they wore costumes, okay? In the same way that if you go to some sort of procession, you dress in finery. In this case, they often, since they were talking about the rebirth of all nature, they would often wear animal skins. It was traditional that the figure wearing the goat skin sang a solemn and haunting song. The song of that goat was the tragodia, the song of the goat, from which we get our word tragedy. So it quite literally means the song of the goat. And it is interesting, you'll see, part of the greatness of Sophocles' Oedipus Rex is it takes that notion. When Oedipus, at the end of the play, is forced out of Thebes, having taken on himself the punishment for the crimes that have been committed, he indeed becomes that figure we know of as the scapegoat. The one who takes on himself the burden of all the sins and wrongs and then is cast out from the people. It's the reason the goat's song was haunting and tragic. It's the reason why our notion of tragedy comes from the tragodia, the song of the goat. And in Oedipus, we get one of the great figures in all great drama of that vision of the scapegoat, as we call it. The one who takes on those burdens and is thrust out from the human community as a result. This festival became formalized, and it was not just a matter of processions through the street. A place was needed. A festival was established, basically what we could think of as a spring festival. And in that spring festival, Dionysus was worshipped, but worshipped then through not just songs, although the songs continued in the great choral odes in the Greek tragedies, but in drama. It is important to understand that the theater then, the Greek theater, grew out of worship, out of a sense of the sacred, out of a need, a genuine need within the community to worship its gods. Open-air arenas were built. You can still see them if you travel to Greece. The best preserved of them all is the great theater in Epidaurus, and it's extraordinarily well preserved. They still perform the Greek plays there, although you don't see them totally authentically. I'll mention that in just a moment. But what you do see is the remarkable construction. What you have, they were basically circular in nature. They were built into hillsides, built into natural settings. Stone seats, rings of stone seats on which the spectators would sit. The acoustics in those theaters to this day are baffling. When I visited Epidaurus myself, the tour guide went down, stood in the center of the stage a long way away, whispered, and in the back of the rows we could hear perfectly clearly. It's an extraordinary thing to hear. They had a knack for that sort of thing. You would have as many as 10 to 15,000 people sitting in these theaters. And the entire city would turn out. It was a festival for the entire community. The only thing we have like it in our own time, I fear, is the Super Bowl, where the life of a nation stops and all gather together on a particular day for some sort of, in our case, bizarre ceremony. I'll actually come back to that in a moment. There are a couple of other bizarre parallels. You'll notice, of course, that there is nothing sacred other than, of course, what we do worship, which is materialism. And the whole point of the Super Bowl is for those commercial advertisers to pay millions so that their products can be seen by the populace and the golden arches may be worshipped. In any case, huge open-air arena, 10 to 15,000 people, the whole city turning out for a festival of tragedies, of plays, in honor of Dionysus. What would the subject be? The subject would be the great Greek myths. This huge body of tales handed down from generation to generation that the playwrights could draw on. It was a great honor. It was an extraordinary honor to be one of those in that dramatic competition. And indeed, as with the Super Bowl, it was a contest. There was a winner. Three tragedians, three playwrights would be selected for each spring festival. That writer would have to write a three-part play. That is, dealing with the same myth in three separate, we would think of them as one-act dramas, that connected in some way, that would be acted throughout the course of one of the days of the festivals, and then, having gone through the three serious plays, basically a trilogy, the same writer would have to write a comic afterpiece dealing with the same subject matter. So that, basically, three one-act tragedies followed by a comic afterpiece. We only possess one complete trilogy. All three plays that were written together. And that is the great Oresteia of Aeschylus. An extraordinary piece of work, one of the earliest of the Greek tragedians. In fact, I'll speak about Aeschylus in just a moment. He's the first of the great Greek tragedians whose work comes down to us. So on each of the 3 days, three plays, a comic afterpiece. The next day, the next playwright would present his three plays, comic afterpiece. Same thing on the following day. And again, whole city turning out. And then the panel of 10 judges would award a prize. There was no higher prize that could be won in the city-state of Athens than to win the Festival of Dionysus, than to win that competition. We know that Sophocles won it more than any other playwright. We have a kind of trilogy with the three, they're called the three Theban plays, the three plays set in Thebes. But sadly, even though the three make up a series, they were written at three different points in Sophocles' life. That is, the Oedipus Rex that we'll be looking at is the part of a trilogy, the other two plays are lost. Oedipus at Colonus, part of a trilogy, the other two plays are lost. And the Antigone, part of a trilogy, the other two plays are lost. But if you put the three together, you get a kind of sequence, but it's an artificial one. Why did that happen? Well, sadly, because Sophocles wrote 123 plays. We possess seven of them. So that what we have is extremely meager, and we're lucky to have the ones that we do have. We are particularly lucky to have the Oedipus Rex, because we know it was among the most highly honored of all the plays written during that golden age of the Greek theater. Aristotle in his Poetics, which I'll speak about later this morning, Aristotle in his Poetics uses Sophocles' Oedipus Rex as a model for what tragedy should be. Which means Aristotle praises it as about the best that you can do in Greek tragedy. And it is an extraordinary gift that we have been given, that we have this play that was considered about the best that you could do. It was one of the seven we have. The other 116 are lost to us. We cannot overestimate the loss to the world when the great library in Alexandria was burned. When that fire was set, what went up within the walls of that great library is almost overwhelming. We probably would have all the plays of Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides, but they're gone now. The modern attitude towards that loss is given to us in the play of a modern playwright, George Bernard Shaw, who in his Caesar and Cleopatra has a messenger run up to Caesar and say, "Caesar, they're burning the great library in Alexandria." Caesar says, "Yes, The messenger says, but the memory of mankind is being burned. And Shaw Caesar says, a shameful memory, let it burn. That's the modern attitude towards the glories of the past. Aeschylus, I'm going to go through the four great Greek playwrights, and give you a little bit of background. There, it's not a huge body of work. Again, we have seven plays by Aeschylus, seven by Sophocles, a few more by Euripides. There aren't that many. They're worthy of study. We're looking at one of them. They are worthy of study. They're remarkable plays. These are approximate dates. These are guesses. We don't know for certain. Aeschylus is the oldest of them. Or 56. 525 to 456 BC. Aeschylus was a great military man. He fought in that great naval battle in 480. And he was known as a military man, and indeed, what he had put on his tombstone was, here lies Aeschylus, who fought in the great naval battle of Salamis. Not that he was a great poet, playwright who had won the festival, although that was a great honor. Aeschylus, in terms of the theater, was hugely important in that he introduced the second actor. This may seem strange. I talked about how Thespis stepped out of the chorus, and you had an interchange between solo actor, solo voice, and chorus. Aeschylus brought another figure out of the chorus, at which point you have dialogue. You have two actors speaking to each other, and you have those two actors who can speak to the chorus, and suddenly whole new possibilities emerge. But it's the reason why you will find in the plays of Aeschylus, you never have more than two actors speaking to each other on stage at the same time. That was the limit. You had the chorus, you had two actors. There are occasions when there may be another figure present, but that figure won't speak. In the Oresteia, when Cassandra is brought back from the Trojan War with Agamemnon, his wife Clytemnestra confronts him, but only the two speak, Agamemnon and Clytemnestra, and Cassandra stands absolutely silent. Until the stage is cleared and then she can speak on her own. You can only have two actors speaking at one time. That was his rule. Aeschylus, his work is defined, and I'm going to use a line from an English poet. What Milton claimed to do in his Paradise Lost, Aeschylus does in his great tragedies, and that is justify the ways of God to men. All of Aeschylus's work, everything that we possess, is about justifying the ways of the gods. The gods rule, the gods are right, and man had better understand that they're right. And all of his work becomes a way of setting forth a divine plan. It's there, we can know it, and mankind should submit to it. In this sense, Aeschylus is, in some regards, the most conservative and traditional of the Greek tragedians. So for that reason, his great trilogy, the Oresteia, about Orestes, the murder of Agamemnon, is really about the setting up of the courts of law, of the coming of the first court of justice with the jury trial in Athens, because the gods intended man to get some of that, to break the old cycle of revenge and murder and set up a system of justice on earth. It was God's plan. Men could fight it, but eventually the gods would prevail. One part of a trilogy we have, his great play Prometheus Bound, is indeed Prometheus chained to that rock because he has violated the order of the gods and brought fire to mankind, and therefore he is punished. And unlike the 19th century English Romantic poets and most of the other Romantic writers for whom Prometheus was a symbol of rebellion, in Aeschylus, Prometheus is getting what he deserves. He had dared to violate the gods' commands. He is punished, and he is being punished with good cause. We lack the rest of that trilogy, but from some fragments we have, it is assumed that what happens is that Prometheus acknowledges his guilt and is reconciled with the gods. Once again, a submission to that divine judgment and that divine order. That's what Aeschylus's plays are all about. They are particularly great in terms of the poetry. I don't read Greek. I'm only reporting what I've been told. It is the common consent. But very difficult, complex, rich verse. In some ways, the most complex of the Greek poet playwrights. Sophocles follows him. And again, I'm giving you approximate dates here. 496 to 406 BC. As I said, Sophocles was, if you will, a golden boy in Athens. From his youth, he was noted for his ability to sing, hence leading the hymns of praise after the great battle. He was known as a model athlete. We have records of him winning athletic competitions. He was a great poet from the beginning. He began writing plays for the festival early on, won more titles than anyone else. He was highly honored by the city. He was, if you will, a model citizen, a model athlete, a model poet, everything about him, to the point that in his 90th year, just before his death, there was a lawsuit brought against him by his own son. And if you look at some time at the Oedipus at Colonus, there is a devastating scene of the blind old Oedipus confronting his own son and berating the boy, and it apparently is a reflection of what had happened with the playwright and his own son. Sophocles' son had tried to have him declared incompetent, no longer able to govern his own affairs or his own estates, and it went to trial in Athens, and legend has it, when Sophocles was asked to make his defense, he simply took a written copy of his Oedipus at Colonus, which he had just written, and put on the judge's bench, and the judge immediately decided he is competent, and the son lost the lawsuit. It's a wonderful story. One of those legends that's so good it's got to be true. What did Sophocles give to the theater? He introduced the third actor. Again, seems odd, but hugely important. We now have three individuals on the stage. We now have multiple conversations. We can now have dialogues, not just between individual actors and chorus, between two actors, but among three. And when you look through the Oedipus Rex, it's one of those things you just take for granted now. But there are wonderful scenes, such as the great scenes between Creon, his sister Iocasta, and Oedipus, where the three characters are speaking together. That would have been hot new stuff in Athens at the time, okay? That would have been amazing stuff to have all of those figures conversing on the stage as well as with the chorus. However, it is still held to three, and you'll notice it's very interesting. The moment when Iocasta goes into the palace, having realized before her son husband does, what the truth of the situation is, goes in to hang herself, immediately the old shepherd comes on stage, would have been the same actor. The same actor who had just exited as Iocasta, quick costume change, mask change, I'll speak of that in just a moment, and the same actor re-enters, now playing the elderly shepherd. We only had the three actors, that was all that was available. They played all the roles. They would do all the roles. They must have been extraordinary. Sophocles, very devout, and I'll get to this when I get to Oedipus, I'm just going to do it quickly here. The whole order of the gods is beginning to be questioned. The divine plan is beginning to be questioned. And Sophocles explores those questions. What is the relationship between God, the gods, and men? For Aeschylus, there's no question. The gods prevail. They are just. End of discussion. For Sophocles, these questions need exploration. These need to be explored. And clearly, that is part of what Oedipus Rex is about. What is the connection between the will of the gods and the ability of an individual man to make decisions? And that tension in that play is overwhelming. We will look at that later. But we see in his greatest play, at least the greatest that comes down to us, or that which Aristotle called the greatest, and I think we can believe his word. We have a kind of explanation that we believe is typical of Sophocles' work. These questions must be examined. These questions must be looked at again and explored. As we will find in the Oedipus Rex, he is going to come down clearly on the same side as Aeschylus. But it is not going to be with the firmness, the unyielding, the deliberate sense that this is the way it is. Sophocles will explore the issue in his plays. The third, Euripides, third of the great playwrights, 445 to 380 BC. Here, by this point, the city is coming to question itself. They have become engaged in the great Peloponnesian Wars that stretched on for years, that ultimately bankrupted the city, devastated its morale. And we get that reflected in the plays of Euripides, who is the doubter. It is fair to say that in his plays, the gods are not only doubted, but often mocked. The gods are juvenile, petty, they are whimsical, and human beings are, if you will, simply at their mercy. But we have the sense with Euripides, there is a genuine question as to whether the gods are there at all. The plays of Euripides are the first plays that we possess that tend, and I'm just speaking of a tendency, tend towards the psychological. The greatness of Euripides is looking at the inner workings of individual human beings. What makes them tick? What governs their emotions? What drives them? What are their passions? So that external vision of Aeschylus that becomes a vision of tension with Sophocles is now, if you will, internalized and made psychological by Euripides. And it's interesting, I think, for this reason. Many of the greatest Euripides characters are women. His great play, The Trojan Women, his Medea, his creation of Phaedra in the Hippolytus, his Alcestis, and his ability to render those human emotions made him want to explore the psychology of the female, because that is the place where these passionate emotions can be most fully displayed, where they are most evident, and can therefore be put down or put on the stage as drama, as great drama. Euripides did not win the prize that often. He was not popular. He was not particularly well-liked, and he was finally driven out of the city. It was so clear in terms of what he was doing that the city, retaining its piety, drove him out. Finally, the great comic playwright, Aristophanes. He comes at the end. I'm sorry, I got these dates wrong. I put his dates for Euripides, 445 to 380. That's Aristophanes. Let me correct this. 480 to 405. 480 to 405 for Euripides, 445 to 380 BC for Aristophanes. Again, these are approximates. These are approximate dates. He is the first great comic playwright. It is very important to keep this in mind. There is a false vision of Aristophanes out there. His comedies are often bawdy by nature. They can be shocking to a modern audience because they're very open in terms of the jokes and the topics that they discuss. But Aristophanes was deeply traditional and conservative. His satire grows out of the fact that he saw Athens coming apart. He is particularly vicious against Euripides. His great play, The Frogs, in which Dionysus goes to the underworld and there's a contest, a tragic contest between Aeschylus and Euripides. All of Aristophanes' sympathies are with Aeschylus, the defender of the gods. and Aristophanes savages Euripides. Aristophanes in the clouds savages Socrates, whom he indeed believed was a corrupter of youth. It is important because what you're going to hear, and it is a big lie out there, is that Aristophanes is a wild-eyed sex jokester. He may use that material because the Greeks were free and easy with that material, but Aristophanes as a playwright is deeply conservative, seeking to conserve that which was best in the city of Athens as he saw it coming apart. He is a satirist in the best sense of the word, which means a comedian who is showing excesses in the hopes of bringing a world back to the normal, to the regular. His great play, Lysistrata, which is the story of the women of Athens going on a sex strike because their husbands are off at war, which is very bawdy, is at core, again, traditional because we are talking only about sex within marriage. These are married couples. These are the wives who are saying, we're being left to run the city. That's not our job. It's time our husbands come home. And since they've disrupted everything domestic in the city, we're going to disrupt what's left and deny them the marriage bed. It's a very funny play. It's a very great play. But it is about conjugal love. And it's a mark of the basic conservative nature. It is easy to be misled by the bawdy jokes. The underlying fact is you have here a very great satirist and a great conservative playwright. I wanted to draw those quick distinctions. The reason I drew them, if you have a basic sense of the playwright, you can explore the plays. And the plays are very great and well worth reading. In the brief time I have remaining in this lecture, I want to get into the theater itself a bit. And what I'm going to do is talk about the Greek theater first as theater, and then we'll go into it as literature. These are two very different things. The theater, of course, is simply a place. It's a mechanism. It's a workshop, if you will, where the ideas of the writers can be set in action, set in motion. But you need a place to do it. I've mentioned already how the great theaters were built into the hillsides. They were very large. They seated a huge number of people. The whole city had to be brought in. They were, however, and I'll just forgive my sketching, this is bad. They were set into the hillside, so they were basically three-quarter round, if you will, okay? Assume rows of seats going up. And in the back, you had a very large, permanent building with enormous double doors, which is why most Greek plays are set in front of a palace, and the doors can be used to go in and out. Oedipus is that way. We're in front of the palace at Thebes. Aeschylus is Agamemnon. We're in front of the palace at Argos. Okay? Most Greek plays in front of a palace. Why? Because that's what was built there. This building was called the Skaena. S-K-E-N-E, from which we get our word scene. It's where the action happens. So the scene of a play is basically that which happens in front of the Skaena. The actors could come in and go out, and behind there were the dressing rooms. What I mentioned earlier, Jocasta leaves the stage and goes into the palace to hang herself. Well, she doesn't. The actor changes his robes, changes his mask, and comes on again from the side. There were entryways from the side, so there could be entrances. Comes on again as the shepherd. So it was a scene, it was a changing room, it was a costume room, but it was also a permanent structure. This large circular area out here was called the orchestra. Sound familiar? And it was the place where the chorus danced and sang. The choral odes were sung and danced, and in fact, the word chorus comes from the Greek for dance. The great Greek tragedies were the first musicals, but a far cry from what we think of as a musical. But what you had was scenes interrupted by big musical numbers. Okay, but it wasn't 42nd Street. Okay, it wasn't Hello, Dolly. These were deeply serious. The poetry tended to predominate over the music, but they were danced, and the chorus had to be dancers. Chorus somewhere around a dozen to 15 to 20 participants. And they had to be very well trained at what they were doing. And the place where the chorus appeared was the orchestra. And in the middle of the orchestra was an altar. Again, the sense of the drama as sacred, the sacramental nature of the drama. There was a permanent altar there. And many of the plays have scenes around an altar so that the characters could come out, and there was the altar. Aeschylus is the libation bearers, where the altar becomes a grave site, and they pour the libations on the grave of Agamemnon. The altar would have been used for that purpose. That altar was always there. It was central. The sacramental nature of the drama was central. Now, given the size, you could not have realistic drama. You couldn't have two little stick figures up there talking to an audience of 15,000 people. They built themselves up. And what you had in terms of the costume were elaborate robes, large masks, so that you did not have an individual actor recognizable playing a role. We're going to go to the theater because Mel Gibson's playing Hamlet tonight, and I'm going to see Mel do the role. Wouldn't matter, you know. We're going to the theater because my favorite Greek actor is doing Oedipus tonight. It wouldn't matter. You got there, the fellow was wearing a mask. You couldn't see him anyway. The mask denied individuality and universalized the drama. These figures were more than just human. They were, if you will, gigantic walking sculpture. And I mean gigantic because the other thing they had, besides the robes and the masks, were gigantic platform shoes called catherni. And I mean platform shoes. If you were playing Oedipus, you probably had 2.5 feet added to your size. So that when you came out and talked to the priest or the messenger or the shepherd, you towered above him. When the gods appeared on the stage, and they did so occasionally, the gods would have about 4 feet added to their size. So at the end of Aeschylus's Oresteia, in the Eumenides, when Apollo appears, he's 10 feet tall. And Orestes may be 8 feet tall, he's the hero, but he's dwarfed by the god, who also, obviously being Apollo, would have worn a gigantic sunburst mask. When Oedipus goes into the palace and blinds himself, he simply would have come out with a different mask, clearly with stains coming from the eye holes, but we still are in the realm of ritual, something very formal, something very solemn. We are looking at a human story elevated by solemnity, dignity, size, scope, a kind of rigidity, in which if you're walking around on 2.5 foot platform shoes, wearing a big mask and draped in robes in that Greek sun, okay, even if it's springtime, it can still be warm, you're not racing around the stage. And the very movements would have had to have been enormous, grand, solemn, formal, which again made it clear that the stories that were being told are gigantic, overpowering, having to do with something beyond the simple day-to-day life as lived in the city of Athens. Going to the theater in Athens meant that the world we viewed was not the ordinary day-to-day world. It was not the world of reality. It was elevated. It was higher. It was ennobled. It was grander. It was more dignified. It was more solemn. It was more majestic. And it quite literally was a vision, even in the actor, of mankind reaching up towards the gods. These figures were larger than life. And the stories they told were larger than the everyday. And the emotions they suffered were grander than what the average theater goer would go through. And the lesson that they learned, that they taught, would be more imposing and more complex than a simple little Aesop's fable, for example. Okay? It is very difficult for us to understand or grasp the immensity of the Greek theater. There was one British director, great British director named Tyrone Guthrie. He was actually an Irishman who, near the end of his career, staged some of the Greek plays as originally done. At the Stratford Festival in Canada, he did an Oedipus Rex that is on film. I haven't been able to find it. It's out there somewhere, and I haven't located it. Done with the masks and the robes. It's very strange because film just can't capture it. At the theater named for him in Minneapolis, he did the Oresteia, all three parts. And it was absolutely stunning, just stunning. These enormous figures, it was not like anything I've ever seen. And even then, I'm sure it was a reflection. It was an attempt to capture what had gone on in the original. But even seeing that attempt was absolutely striking. You were not watching an ordinary play. You were in the presence of something beyond the ordinary. And let me end this lecture by emphasizing this again. The theater, for the Greeks, touched the divine. It was a form of worship. It was a way of touching something sacred. It grew out of their piety, their need to worship, and art was directly connected with worship. After the collapse of the Greek theater, there would not be another golden age of the theater until England, beginning in the 14th and 15th century, going up to the glory of Shakespeare. We'll look at his Hamlet. That began and grew out of the Mass. In all the golden ages of the theater, there has always been that connection between the need to worship and the sense of the divine, and theater becoming one of the ways of doing it. I'll stop there for now. We'll take a break.